Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Devin Olson, and he'll be answering your questions on stillwater fly fishing. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Devin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now or while you're listening to the show, we'd sure appreciate it. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted as the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Devin Olson about stillwater fly fishing. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products include brushes, fibers, and components, and they have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Devin, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Devin's section that says Register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Devin's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing, Competition-Inspired Strategies for Everyday Anglers. Now, here's how you can win. This is courtesy of Stackpole Books, by the way, an excellent publisher of many, many books on fly fishing. So check them out at stackpolebooks.com. We also have a link to Devin's book on our homepage if you'd like to look at it there. But here's how you can win it tonight, and you just have to be the first person to answer the question I ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something that Devin and I had to talk about during the show. So take good notes, type fast, and maybe you'll be the proud winner of Devin's new book, Stillwater Fly Fishing, Competition-Inspired Strategies for Everyday Anglers. Our guest tonight is Devin Olson. Devin started fly fishing in Yellowstone at age 9. Within a couple of years, it became an addiction he could not shake, and he begged for rides to local streams until he could drive. He started competing at age 19 and made Fly Fishing Team USA in 2006 when he was 21 years old. He has competed in many World Fly Fishing Championships since then, and he has earned several individual and team medals from these championships. Away from competitive fishing, he holds a bachelor's degree in ecology and a master's degree in fisheries science. He worked as a fisheries biologist for several years before starting his company, Tactical Fly Fisher. He has produced two instructional films, Modern Nymphing, European-Inspired Techniques, and Modern Nymphing, Elevated Beyond the Basics, and authored a book, Tactical Fly Fishing, Lessons Learned from Competition for All Anglers. And now his most recent book, Stillwater Fly Fishing, as we just talked about. Devin, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Oh, thanks, Roger. Glad to be back.
Yeah, glad to have you back. It's always a pleasure. And I just wanted to, let's see here, check something. Let's see when the first show we did together, because we've done a few now. And I'm always anxious to talk to you about what you've been up to next. But it looks like first show in February 2017. So, folks, just you like what Devin does and says and teaches, check out the other shows we've done with him. We've done Eurostyle Part 2, Lock Style, and Competitive Fly Fishing. So four shows that I've done with Devin. So after tonight, you'll have plenty of more education from Devin, and he's always a great teacher. So, yes, welcome back. Well, you just returned from another fly fishing championship, right?
Yeah, it was my 14th. I'm now 14th. The old part on the team.
Oh, yeah. It's well, you still have a young-looking face, so see, you can pass for younger. Yeah,
well, I'm nearing that decadal turnover to 40, but I haven't quite gotten there yet. But when I was surrounded with a whole bunch of team members that were in their 20s and early 30s, then, you know, now I am officially the old fart on the team. So
you're officially, all right. Did they give you a medal for that or anything?
No, but honorary. We won one, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, kind of give us an overview, you know, because tonight we're talking about Stillwater Fishing and your latest book. And part of that title is, you know, competition-inspired strategies. So tell us, kind of give us an overview of what the championship was like this year, where you were, what the waters were like, and then, you know, maybe some lessons learned, and then maybe focus specifically on the Stillwater, aspect of the competition. So we'd love to hear about that.
Sure. Well, if people want kind of a full breakdown, after every world championship, I typically do a session review of every single session. So I just finished my last one, I think yesterday or the day before. So I have all five sessions that I fished and a breakdown of pretty much the play-by-play of everything I did and the lessons that I learned in every session or things I feel I did or didn't do well. So if people want to go read those, they can find it in the blog post tab on our website at Tactical Fly Fisher. But we were in France this year in the Pyrenees, and that area, well, France in general is known as just an incredibly difficult country to fish in. The rivers and the lakes there, from what I saw, they get a fair amount of pressure. There's also a lot of catch and keep pressure. So kind of through the years, the fish that have survived that catch and keep pressure, whether it's been some artificial selection or just the strain of brown trout that happens to be there, the fish that are left are incredibly wary. They're extremely difficult to catch. They're not terribly large as well, which most people would think that would make them easier. It's the opposite, because most smaller fish tend to be a lot more agile than larger fish, so when you get takes from them, they can take and reject a fly even more quickly than a large fish can by a long shot. So you've never fished for such difficult 8 to 10 inch brown trout, I'll just put it that
way. Wow.
They were incredibly tough. Before this year, I had never thought about using 7 or 8x on lakes before, and I used 7x on these lakes and felt like I had rope. They were so incredibly, they would inspect your flies more so than the toughest tailwater trout I've ever seen or toughest spring creek trout or whatever analogy you want to have of the toughest river or lake you've ever fished in the States. These fish were every bit as tough and tougher. They would come up, and I had several in one lake, I had 4 or 5 brown trout come up and look at my size 20 and 22 shuttlecock dry fly and inspect it from all 4 angles before finally just swimming off.
Yeah.
So they were very, very tough. And so I guess the main lessons from the championship were just sometimes you really have to push the envelope in terms of finesse and ultralight gear and tactics. The field at the World Championships as well, I would say in the last 10 years, has made great strides across the board, from the strongest to the weakest countries, in basically becoming as ultralight and finesse approached as you can get. And it's made it so everybody has gotten a lot better, and everybody tends to be more successful in sessions, which makes the later sessions that much more difficult, because once those fish have been pestered, you know, in the first and second and third sessions, then those fourth and fifth sessions get really hard because those fish
are
on alert. Yeah. So yeah. The same pieces of water get fished for 5 days in a row, and by the fourth and fifth days, they get awfully tough.
Yeah. And Yeah, I would assume re-entering too. I was watching some of the videos on, once you guys catch something, you got to run to the shore, right? To get it
Yeah. So
inspected and
you bring
verified. And...
a fish to, in the water to the controller, and then you quickly measure it before it's released and have to at least be 20 centimeters or larger to count. But on the lakes, getting back to that,
Yeah.
I would say in general, it was a more finesse-based, more technical-based kind of small fly approach than I've really ever had on lakes in a championship before. We were fishing these high mountain lakes in the Pyrenees there, these chains of them, kind of, small glacial lakes, similar to what you might find here in the western United States and some of our mountain ranges that have a lot of high mountain lakes, except that these were pretty much all wild brown trout. There were some wild rainbows in the Carlit Lakes, but it was mainly the Mediterranean strain of brown trout, and they were all wild, and there were very high numbers of them in the lakes. There was no shortage of fish, but they were the most spooky, most kind of hard to catch on alert fish I've seen in high lakes before. Compared to the most of the high lake fishing that we do here in the West, it was on an entirely different level. So I ended up fishing a lot of small flies. I mean, a lot of tactics were good crossovers from high lake fishing that you might do here. Lots of dry fly fishing with ants and small midges, which that's not uncommon in our high lakes here, but also both washing line and or dry and two dropper rigs, all on 7X and size 20 and 22 zebra midges below very small dry flies or hung on a washing line with a dry fly on the end. None of the kind of flashier, kind of attractor-based lure approaches that I talk about in the book a lot that you might find in other lakes. None of that was played here. There were very few people that caught fish doing what I refer to in the book as pulling flies, which is just like, casting and retrieving flies quickly, which is a very common approach in a lot of lakes, but here it was just not the best way to go about it most of the time, especially when there wasn't much wind, which
And
most of the
these
time it was
were,
fairly calm.
yeah. Now these fish in the lakes, were they, would you call holdovers from stocking in previous years, or were these stocked
I don't
fish?
know the history. My guess is that originally they were stocked a long time ago, just like a lot of the wild fish in our lakes at home. Because I would assume most of these lakes were high up in the Pyrenees, and I would be surprised if there weren't some barriers to migration that would have, not prevented them from colonizing those lakes originally from rivers lower down. But if they were stocked, it was many decades ago, and those
Okay,
fish
so they
that are in
weren't
there now are all wild fish.
yeah, okay, yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at, because were the streams more put and take fisheries in general, or
No, I mean,
were they
everywhere,
also wild
all the fish
fish?
that we fished
Okay.
to the whole championship were wild. There were no stocked fisheries.
Okay.
It was all wild, but still it had a lot of catch and keep pressure in those rivers. For instance, the
Okay.
Vic Dussault River that we were on, I was told by the locals there that they have a 10 fish limit on that river, and
Oh
they
my
just have to
gosh.
be over 20 centimeters. And so you could imagine why there were a whole heck of a lot of fish that were just shy of that 20 centimeter mark that didn't count. So,
Oh, God. Gosh, that's a high limit in my mind,
oh yeah,
that's incredible.
it's
Yeah.
crazy, but there's still a very much a tradition there, even like a supplying restaurants and stuff with fish. It's such a, a culinary culture of, and that includes still the trout.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'd like to talk to you about your book that you just came out with, The Stillwater Fly Fishing. And what were your goals in writing that? Considering most of the work that you've done has been in kind of the Euro nymphing world, right? And this is,
I mean,
I know
most of
we,
the instruction I've done, but I think that it's a common misconception of, all you have to do is watch a few videos online from certain influencers to hear that all we do is Euro nymph and competition, and that's just simply not true. Not even close to true. So basically, I look at, most of the literature and the instruction that's been out there, and there's a very different style in Europe, and in especially the UK competition stillwater scene. There's a very different style there in a lot of ways than a lot of the style that has evolved in North America. So I think of, I just feel like there was a sort of a knowledge that has come from that side of the pond and the styles of fishing that I've learned from fishing competitions that hasn't really been taught to most anglers here in the United States. There's plenty of good education that's out there for folks who still water fish, but as a result, you see sort of folks that do a few things here in the United States, like fish indicators with chironomids under them, or just troll around in their float tube and, you know, troll some leech flies, stuff like that.
But
there's some far more active approaches, a lot of attractor-based approaches, a lot of kind of shock and awe, or I just call it pulling flies, casting and retrieving flies often at speed, that especially is common in the UK lock style stillwater scene that we just haven't been exposed to for the most part here in the United States. So I felt like, just like with Euro nymphing, where there, until recently, there was not much of that knowledge being shared in North America, I felt like I could bring a little bit of that competitive knowledge from Europe and share for anglers here who are interested in adopting other styles and finding out what works for them, and maybe is also potentially a little more exciting too, especially when it comes to lock style fishing.
Okay, good. Couple little short questions here before we go to a break here. J.D. Murphy wants to know, he said, where did you get the photo on the cover of your new book? Looks like this guy can cast.
Well, yeah, that was a cheeky little question, because J.D. happens to be the father of Connor Murphy, who is the person on the front cover of the book. Connor, my good friend Connor, and former manager of my shop, we were on a backpacking trip in the middle of a remote set of mountains, and I was sitting there taking photos of him fishing the lake from up on the hill, because the fishing happened to be actually quite poor that day, so I figured it was a good chance to get some photos for the book.
Yeah. Well, he can cast, and I suppose JD can take credit for teaching him, right? Yeah.
Well, why not? You know, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, you always have to toot your kid's horn, right, whenever you get that
Yeah,
chance,
well, so, as yeah. a father, you know, we got to take credit where credit is due, right?
That's true, too. Yes, you do, too. Yes, yeah. Good. The other question came in on the Internet from Phil in Kentucky. He wanted to know about the story behind the photo with you of the huge brown trout on our homepage.
Oh, well, I actually don't know which photo specifically that was, but if it's the one I'm thinking of that I think you used previously, I think it's in the book as well.
I caught that
fishing lock style on a lake in southeast Wyoming, and I was there with my friend Josh Graffam. We were there in the fall, just kind of drifting lock style along this bank. We caught a whole bunch of big brown trout and big rainbows that day, mainly just casting and retrieving what I call the humongous woolly bugger. It's this pattern that came from Scotland, but the polar version, I was fishing that. And then we were fishing also, if I remember right, some kind of black bunny-style boobies to keep the flies just above the bottom in a bay that we were drifting into. And I caught two or three brown trout that were pretty similar in size to that day.
Nice. Yeah. Beautiful fish. Yeah. So, well, let's take a quick break. When we return, we'll answer more of the questions with Devin about stillwater fly fishing. So hang tight. We'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call, and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Devin Olson about Stillwater Fly Fishing, competition-inspired strategies. If you'd like to ask Devin a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. So, Devin, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. Well, obviously, we've talked about two of the things, your book and the competition. What else is happening?
Yeah, actually, I had another couple of competitions this last weekend, just some regional qualifiers for Team USA. Ended up being fortunate to win both of those, so that was good.
Oh.
And then other than that, just kind of, you know, doing as much fishing during the week as I can. And then if my wife happens to be on shift on the weekends, I'm taking my kids out on the water with me most weekends as well. And whether they fish or they just swim while I fish right by them, you know, I'm getting some fishing in that way at least. So yeah, that's, you know, just kind of back to day-to-day fishing now for a little bit, and then I'll be doing some, I'll actually be headed back into some high lakes on a big backpacking trip with my wife in August, and then rolling back into more competitions in September, and then a trip to Spain as well to go fish with my friend Pablo from the Spanish team and his friend David. So I've got a hosted trip that we're doing in Spain in September. So at least on the short range docket, that's what's happening.
Nice, nice. Well, tell folks about your business too.
Yeah, so I own a fly shop, an online fly shop called Tactical Fly Fishing. And really it started mainly because back when I was a biologist but still competing, I was having a hard time getting sort of niche materials from Europe, and a lot of the things that I needed for urinymphing and tying specific flies. And so I started my own shop to be able to source it easier, and it's kind of grown into what it is now, which is a fairly expansive fly shop. We focus a lot on urinymphing and kind of high-level stillwater fishing and technical dry fly fishing, so kind of strategies that come out of competition and have trickled down to others through, whether it be through, you know, my content or others. I'm just trying to help make people better anglers as well as I can through sharing information and then helping people pick up the gear that goes along with that.
And you want to share your domain?
Yeah, it's just tacticalflyfisher.com.
Or there you go, folks.
Put in Tactical Fly Fisher into Google, you'll get right there, no problem.
Okay, all right, good. Well, thanks for sharing. All right, well, let's get back to some of these questions. Roy Fukushima in Orange County wanted to know how you got into fly fishing and fly tying. It's in your bio. What did we say? You started at, age 9
yeah,
or
so,
something? What was that?
So I actually started tying flies before I first caught a fish on a fly rod. You know, I started fishing when I was a little kid. My parents have a picture when I was 18 months old of me holding up some rainbow that was probably caught on power bait or something. I don't even know. But then my dad actually taught me how to tie a woolly worm when I was 7. Mainly so that he wouldn't have to tie me woolly worms. we went and I fished a bubble and a fly in some high lakes with him for a couple of years there. And then when I was 9, that was the first time I actually caught a fish on a fly rod. And kind of the rest has been history ever since.
Yeah, good. So your dad was a fly fisher as well?
Yep, long line of them. Actually, I have an ancestry of commercial fishermen in Norway. And my grandfather, who was Danish, he also fly fished. I don't know how far back on his side it went, but whether it started with him or not, my grandfather fly fished, and, you know, then my dad, and now my brother and I, and now my kids and my wife. So hopefully we have a long tradition coming of fly angling in the family.
Yeah, that's interesting how it's passed down. Mine was a bit different. My dad taught me how to fish, and I taught him how to fly fish. When I was 13, I taught him how to fly fish, and now I've taught my son, and we're teaching my grandson now, too. So, yeah, it's nice to – and the nicest thing is when you can get a whole group of you out on the river at the same time, you know. So, yeah, it makes the world very special.
Yeah, there's a fun photo in the book. There's a fun photo in the book, actually, of – my dad and myself and my son in the boat with my son landing a fish that he just hooked on a fly rod.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah, he was pretty little at that point, so I'm pretty sure that either my dad or I made the cast, but he at least set the hook and did the rest of it. So.
Yeah, well, you got to start at some point, right? Yeah, so,
yep.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. Well, let's talk about Stillwaters here. In your book, you start out in the book by talking about tropic states of Stillwater. Can you help us understand, you know, what those are and, you know, explain what tropic state is of a Stillwater and help us to understand how it can help us to be more productive?
Sure. So, slight typo there. It's actually trophic state. And so
did I say tropic?
Yep. So it's trophic. There's a pH in there. But the trophic state is basically just the nutrient load that's in the Stillwater. So you have everything from an ultra oligotrophic lake. That would be a really infertile lake that has very little amount of dissolved solids and nutrients in it. Low dissolved ion content, just kind of really infertile. So a lot of high lakes in the Rocky Mountains would probably fall under that category. There's some, it's usually large, steep-sided glacial origin lakes that tend to be ultra-oligotrophic, or some sort of deep, high mountain reservoirs that don't have a lot of nutrient load coming in would fit into either ultra or just oligotrophic. So oligotrophic lakes, they're not very fertile. They don't tend to have, you know, a lot of algal or macrophyte growth. They're usually clear water, and as a result, their food web and their food production tends to be pretty limited, kind of to small midges, a few zooplankton, calanoids, and a few daphnia sometimes, but you don't get a lot of larger-bodied macroinvertebrates, you know, not a lot of dragonflies, damselflies, Calabatus mayflies, you know, the types of things that you tend to find in strong weed beds. So then mesotrophic would be still waters that are kind of medium in nutrient load. A lot of the most famous lakes that are out there probably would fall into that category because their mesotrophic tends to be about the, you know, the category where trout fisheries can be really productive, have good nutrient and productivity capacity, but still remain cold enough and deep enough in certain points of it that they'll harbor trout. A lot of what we would call eutrophic still waters, which are, you know, the most nutrient heavy, have the most primary production capability, they tend to be really shallow and have a lot of sometimes pollution coming into them. You know, it can be high nutrient loads from land-based practices that, whether it's erosion or, you know, sewage treatment that's not actually tertiary treatment to treat nutrients, things like that. If you have a lot of nutrient load coming into a place and it's shallow, then it tends to be eutrophic. And that's when you get a pond that has just weed mats everywhere and you can't even see into it because all you can see is weeds by midsummer, you know. So those tend to be a lot of the shallow ponds that maybe people put grass carp and things like that into to basically graze down the algae and the macrophytes. But mesotrophic, that, you know, think of maybe, I would have to actually look at the metrics, the different ways that limnologists do sampling, but I would guess places like Henry's Lake or, Henry's Lake, Island Park Reservoir, some of those that are up there, Hebgen Lake, some of the famous reservoirs that are up there, those would probably fall under that mesotrophic category, and they tend to make some of the best fisheries, a lot of the ones in Oregon as well. So, but oligotrophic lakes can still provide good trout fisheries. They just, if you're going to have a good, you know, a large fish in a oligotrophic system, there tends to be a low density of fish to get there. So, for instance, in the high lakes that I tend to cover or target, you can go to high alpine lakes that have a pretty large biomass of fish, but it's all in like 6 to 8 inch increments of fish, you know, just stunted fish that there's not a lot of food to go around, so if you have a lot of mouths to feed, they don't get very large. But a couple drainages over, or even, you know, further up the chain, if you have a lake that doesn't have a lot of spawning habitat and the numbers of fish are lower, you can still get some pretty good fish, but there just has to be fewer mouths to feed. So mesotrophic lakes, though, because they have higher primary productivity and the whole way through the food chain tends to be supported with a higher nutrient load and more production capacity, then you can feed more mouths and still get, you know, large fish. And so a lot of the most famous lakes that are out there that fall under that category, you can catch a lot of nice, you know, sized fish.
So what I'm hearing from you is the trophic state of a lake or reservoir should help you to kind of shape your expectations. In other words,
shape your expectations, but also once you know what kind of reservoir or lake you're looking at, if you're looking at an oligotrophic system and you don't see much weed growth and you're not seeing a lot of large insects and whatnot flying around, then you can also adjust your fly selection and your presentation to suit that.
Right.
So in high lakes, you can still end up using a tractor-based pulling approaches, and they work really well, but you might also want to do a lot of fishing with smaller nymphs and midge pupa and smaller dry flies that are common for the small coronamids that tend to be in those systems. There's a lot in oligotrophic-based systems. You get a lot of smaller species of coronamids that are like size 16 all the way down to 24s, whereas in mesotrophic systems, you get all those other species of mayflies, of caddis, of dragonflies, damsels, a lot of leeches a lot of times, a lot of scuds if you have the right water chemistry and weed beds. So you just have a wider variety of larger food forms in mesotrophic lakes, and that can inform your fly selection as well.
Yeah. I've got a little lake that's on the property down the hill from me here that's 8,800 feet. It's not a high mountain lake, but 8,800 feet in elevation. But it's a farm lake, a couple acres, and cattle grazing around it and hay, that kind of thing. But it grows weeds like incredibly weed growth. In fact, once every year, we take a cable and go around the lake and drag a cable through and cut the weeds out and dump them on the side, and they're growing back, you know, right away. So do you think a lot of that weed growth is from nutrients coming from the cattle and, you know, waste? And I don't think they fertilize the hay fields or anything, but where do you think that – it's a shallow lake, maybe 12 feet deep.
Yeah, I mean, part of that just has to do with the soil that it's in, right? So that's the basic thing that informs the nutrient load of a lake to begin with. It's just the geology that it comes from. And sometimes literally a different rock layer and a different drainage can make a lake far more or far less productive. So the geology has a lot to do with it. If you have a lot of soft soils that are nutrient rich around, and you have water dissolving through that and going into the lake as a result, then you're going to have a pretty high nutrient load. And then if you dump surface fertilizer on top of that through manure, then yeah, that certainly contributes to nutrient load and would lead to higher dissolved everything, basically, that feeds that primary productivity at the base of the food chain.
Yeah, it produces a lot of bugs, damsels, mayflies, caddis. I mean, midges, everything comes off that lake. So the fish grow rather quickly from 9 inches to 16 inches in just a year or two, it seems like. So I think it's really nutrient rich. I was just kind of wondering, because I hear what you're saying. If you go up to one of the high mountain lakes, you've got that rock base, right? You don't have this river bottom soils underneath the lake and so forth like you do where I am now. You know, it's a river valley. So I hear what you're saying. Yeah, about that. Yeah. All where it started, so to speak. Okay. Phil just said about your photo of that brown trout. He says, I got to do what Devin's doing. Okay, so listen up, Phil. Devin's going to tell you here. So then you talk in your book about different zones that compose a lake and understanding how those might, the littoral and the profundo and pelagial zones. Can you tell us about those and what we should be looking at there?
Sure. So really what it all boils down to is sunlight. And you can divide still waters into different areas that either receive sunlight or don't. So I need to actually pull the book out because I've forgotten the specific term about the limit right now. But there's the littoral zone will be anywhere in the shallows.
Yeah, page four. All right. This is good. See, this is what happens when you do a master's degree in limnology and fisheries ecology, and then you actually don't use it for a few years. But you write a book and you try and forget about it as soon as possible. But let's see here, page four. So anyway, the compensation depth, that was the word I was looking for. So the shallows, you have the littoral zone, and that is anywhere where light can penetrate and actually reach the bottom. So out away from that zone, if you go to what's called the compensation depth, so that's basically where sunlight has penetrated the lake but then attenuates and eventually it doesn't go any further, or there's not enough light to actually provide energy for photosynthesis. So that compensation depth, if you then go horizontally out into that still water, below that compensation depth, between there and the bottom in that zone, would be called the profundal. And then above that compensation depth, if you're out over open water, that would just be the photic zone within the pelagial waters. So most people would just refer to it as open water, but it's just kind of water that's not really in contact with the shoreline or with the bottom, but it's still receiving sunlight. There are separate, you know, not entirely separate, but somewhat separate food webs for both of those zones, the pelagial and the littoral. The profundal is not generally a zone that has a lot of fish activity, for at least for fly fishing, because we simply can't reach it most of the time with our gear. Some, you know, a lot of guys targeting lake trout with deep trolling or jig rigs might be able to get down to the profundal. But typically in clear lakes, you're looking at 30, 40, 50, 60 feet deep or deeper for the compensation depth to actually, you know, reach it if you have a really clear lake. In a less clear lake, it might only be, you know, 15, 20 feet, maybe even 10 if it's quite murky. But typically most fly fishers focus on the littoral zone because that's where most of the photosynthesis happens for macrophytes. You know, macrophytes are rooted weeds that are growing out of the substrate along the bottom, along the edges of still water. And so when you have weeds and you have a strong base of the food chain there, then you get primary consumers that live on those, all the macroinvertebrates, you know, that turn into the bugs that trout eat, and or feed the small fish that then trout eat, you know. So the littoral zone is the most productive area in most lakes, but in a lot of trout lakes, especially steep-sided ones, the pelagial zone ends up being incredibly important as well, and it's often forgotten about by most fly fishers. And there are a lot of lakes out there that really don't have a very well-functioning littoral zone because they're either steep-sided or it's a reservoir that gets drawn down quickly throughout the growing season, and it can't really establish weed beds and, you know, a functioning littoral zone in that regard. So most of the food chain and the stillwater food web ends up being pelagial-based, and it starts with phytoplankton that feed zooplankton, and then the zooplankton either feed trout directly or they feed other fish that then the trout feed on. So there's a lot of, especially large stillwaters in the West, that if you were to take samples, for example, of what fish were eating throughout the year, there's a specific stillwater I'm thinking of and that they did a food web study on, very famous stillwater in Utah, that 80% of what they were eating throughout the year for the most part was Daphnia, which is a zooplankton, and they were mostly eating it from the pelagial zone. But yet most fly fishers there focus on the littoral zone and on other food sources, you know. So keeping in mind that there are various places the fish can eat from, and then as a result, various parts of the food web have different food sources depending upon what zone you're at in a stillwater.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. Your picture in your book is really, really shows what you've just talked about. It makes sense, even in our little lake here. You know, you have the open water, you've got the weed beds, and so forth. And
my guess is that with your specific lake example, I would bet that entire lake is a littoral zone.
Yeah, I would bet
so
too.
So if you've got weeds, you know, growing straight up from the bottom, or if you go out there and you see actual weed growth on the bottom, that is still the littoral zone. There's still light reaching the bottom.
Right.
It's more in, you know, larger, deeper lakes
that the pelagic zone tends to be, you know, a little more important.
Yeah, and what you also said about, you know, large lakes or reservoirs where the water's drawn down and that littoral zone doesn't get to shape up, right? Makes total sense. Fred just wrote in here on the internet. He said, when the surface water heats up, jigging deep 35 to 70 feet at Pyramid Lake really paid off. Just sharing an experience he had. But that kind of shows you, I've never been to Pyramid Lake, but I expect that most of that is Pelagio, right? I don't know.
Yeah,
have you been
yeah.
there?
In fact, yeah. Most people kind of focus on the beaches out there where you can access the deeper water from a standing position, kind of on a berm of sand, you know, out on a ladder or whatever.
Right.
But the food web in Pyramid is almost entirely pelagic based. So you've got this really strong density of zooplankton that are out there, and then they feed the tui chubs and the Sacramento perch, and those feed the cutthroats. So it's a pretty simple food web out there. There's not a lot of, other than like chironomids, there's not really a lot of other typical weed-based insects that you might find in other famous big trout-producing lakes.
Right, right. Let me take another quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about the food web you mentioned and dig into that a little bit more. Discover the power of pure skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft tackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead, trout, or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips to elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's pureskagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Devin Olson about stillwater fly fishing, competition-inspired strategies. If you'd like to ask Devin a question, just go to our homepage and fill out that form, send it in. We'll try to get it answered tonight on the show. Couple of questions came in while we were talking, Devin. Brad in San Diego, how does one find out about fly fishing competitions? Are spectators allowed to watch? Are there any in the western states, specifically California? I feel that watching good fishermen fish is a great way to learn and get educated. Being from San Diego, there's not much fly fishing for trout around here. My home waters would be the Eastern Sierras, which is a good 5 to 6 hour drive. So can you help
yeah,
him
so,
out?
I mean, the easiest way to find out about them, specifically kind of the background info, there's a couple of podcasts that I did with Lance Egan and Pablo Signori and Pat Weiss that we did all about competition fly fishing, and that those podcasts are on the Noob and the Knower. There was a couple episodes there that'll run you through kind of everything that happens. Also, I talked a fair bit about it on the podcast I did with April Vokey when I was on there with her. But if you want to find out about the specific competitions themselves and where they're at and when they're held, we have the Fly Fishing Team USA website that we normally have a schedule on there, as well as flycomps.com. That's the actual website where people go and register, and so all the competitions are listed there. But, yeah, spectators are always welcome, you know, as long as you're kind. and in most places, we don't have a lot of spectators, but when we do, a lot of them come away with some definite, you know, tips and benefits that kind of spawned then questions that they asked me later. So I used to have, especially back when I lived in Colorado, there were a few people there that would come around and watch me and the other competitors in the competitions I was fishing there. And I always got a lot of good questions from them afterwards, you know, asking about specific things that I did and why I was doing it. And it was actually pretty thought-provoking for me as well, because then I had to actually come up with an explanation a lot of times of why I was just doing something that was natural. Folks are always welcome. There aren't a lot of competitions in California simply because there aren't very many competitors there that have gotten on the circuit. But There are competitions to the north in Oregon fairly often, but at this point, the main zones of competitions tend to be in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, and then North Carolina, Georgia, and Pennsylvania and New York. Those are kind of the hotbeds right now of where there's the most active anglers competing.
Yeah. Was the first competition in Colorado for the U.S.?
That was the first national championship. We had
national
a few
championship. Yeah.
Competitions leading up to that elsewhere. But, yeah, I fished in that first Nationals in 2006.
Yeah, and that's when I started this podcast, was 2006. And I went out on the water and interviewed a bunch of you guys. I don't remember if I talked to you or not. But, yeah, it was all kind of new and fresh and and very, very intriguing and interesting back then. But, yeah, I remember doing that. Lily Lake, I think.
My, how things have changed since 2006.
Yeah. Oh, in so many ways, in so many ways. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about, JD, who you know well, wants to know, can you talk about your worm pattern in Gilbert's recent online video?
I think he's referring to the DNA worm. So the DNA worm is basically, it was an attempt to get a squirmy wormy that was a lot more durable. So it's a pattern made of hairline life flex. I take two strands of it, spin it together, and what ends up looking like a double helix once you then spin it back on itself. That's why I call it the DNA worm. And I have a tutorial on our YouTube channel for people to go learn how to tie it if they want.
Okay.
But it's a worm pattern that works really well. It's actually a great stillwater pattern if you want to hang it under an indicator or under a dry fly or fish it like on a washing line, just really slow. It works really well in stillwaters.
Okay. All right, let's talk about the food webs. And you have a whole chapter in your book about that. And there are different food webs depending on what zones we're talking about, the pelagic or the littoral, right? So can you maybe explain the difference and how we would fish those differently because of the food webs?
Sure. Well, there, I kind of touched on it a little bit when we were talking about the zones, but no matter what, whenever you have a food web, that you can almost think of it as two separate food chains almost, or at least kind of more less complex food webs within each of those zones, and then they're bridged by the trout and the other fish that end up swimming back and forth. So you get nutrients mixing between the two zones, mainly by larger bodied organisms as well as currents in the lake. But at the, you know, at any food web, the base of it's always your primary producers. So in the littoral zone, that's going to be the macrophytes, those rooted macrophytes, and there's also epiphytes and periphyton that live on the rocks and those plants themselves. So basically algae, that there's actual algae that then lives on those macrophytes, on their leaves, so they use them as the substrate. Those would be epiphytes. And then the periphyton, they tend to live on the rocks. So the algae that you might go flipping around on if you went to wade on, a lot of that's periphyton. So those are your primary producers. Then you're going to have grazers or, you know, primary consumers, which a lot of those are macrophytes, just small macroinvertebrates. So you could have scuds. You could have other insect macroinvertebrates like mayfly nymphs, caddis nymphs. Damselflies and dragonflies are usually secondary consumers, so they eat the primary consumers, they're predators. And then you've got small fish that end up preying on all of those, both of those primary and secondary consumers, and trout that prey on them. And then, you know, you have those avian predators and the other things that are catching those trout, and then those nutrients end up going back in either through the fecal matter of those avian birds, or if you get trout that just die, then you get those decomposers, the scavengers like crawfish, et cetera, that kind of close that food web on that side. You're looking, you know, more at rooted plants, lots of different insects and macroinvertebrates,
right.
A fairly complex community of the macroinvertebrate side on the littoral zone, and then the fish that feed on them. Out in the pelagic zone, it starts with phytoplankton, so basically free-living algae or plankton species that are out there. And then they end up getting eaten by zooplankton, and there's lots of different types of zooplankton. Most people don't even know about the bulk of them. The very few that fly fishers that are kind of tuned into the zooplankton side of things think of Daphnia, but there's a lot more than Daphnia out there. There's copepods, calanoids, you know, different types of that side of it as well. And in some high lakes, those can actually be really important. But Daphnia tend to be the biggest food source for trout. And then you have, other than the trout, you've got, you know, like bait fish species that might be out there eating the Daphnia as well, and then the trout might eat the bait fish. Or another fish that's really common in a lot of still waters that really focuses on zooplankton would be kokanee salmon. So then you might have trout that eat the kokanee salmon, or, for instance, like lake trout, which they're kind of like that apex predator out mm-hmm. there in the pelagic zone eating kokanee and or trout. So it's a little bit simpler in the food web as far as the breadth of the community out in the pelagic zone than it might be in the littoral zone, but it's still a very important zone for production. It just happens to be out over open water instead of with rooted plants.
Yeah.
And then,
so,
you know, you get crossover between them.
Yeah. I'm, you know, again, looking at your diagram in your book, and it shows it very effectively. What I'm seeing here is that in the pelagic zone, am I correct in that you're not going to be having the hatches out there that you would in the littoral zone? You're better off fishing.
Yeah. So that largely that's true. There are some deep dwelling species of chironomids and insects called a phantom midge that can hatch over deep water. But in general, it's not really an insect hatch based, you know, part of the food web out there. It's mainly
right.
fish that are focusing on zooplankton or the bait fish that are eating them. So you're typically not imitating anything specific out over pelagic water in the same way, because there's not really anything that's imitatable. There's a lot of people who've tried to come up with Daphnia cluster flies and things like that, but the interesting part about it, if you watch fish feeding on Daphnia, they're not eating clusters.
Yeah.
The Daphnia is still split apart in the water. They might be in dense clouds sometimes, but they're not actually clustered. And most trout don't have gill rakers that have narrow enough gaps between their gill rakers that they can just filter feed on them, like, you know, baling with a whale, for instance. Kokanee do. They have gill rakers that are closer together, so they're more effective at feeding on zooplankton. But trout pretty much still have to swim along and chomp on them as they go.
Yeah.
And I haven't found anybody who's come up with something that I would consider to be an actual Daphnia pattern that the trout eat it for Daphnia. There's people who catch flies on quote-unquote Daphnia patterns, but I don't think it's necessarily because they're actually eating it as Daphnia. So typically in the pelagic zone, it's more of a pulling lure-based method
right.
for me, you know, pulling flashy flies that tend to get attention and kind of break trout out of the doldrums with something to chase.
Yeah. Yeah, or terrestrials possibly.
Yeah, absolutely.
From a tractor standpoint.
That's another connection there, where you'll get a lot of blow-ins out over open water, whether it's ants,
right.
beetles, or other terrestrials. And you definitely can have some good dry fly fishing over open water as a result.
Yeah, yeah. Ed in Wisconsin wrote in, he says, how do you determine the depth and structure when fishing a lake in competition? He says, I assume... Phipps-Mouche rules do not allow depth finders.
Yep, so that's true. We aren't allowed electronics in Phipps-Mouche competitions. So really it comes down to, you know, pretty much observation-based analog methods. I just start looking at the lay of the land around the reservoir or the still water. You know, typically you can always have abrupt changes, just like you'd see outside the lake, but if you have a shallow gradual slope entering a reservoir for a long ways above it, you can typically predict that it's going to be a continuation of that. If you have a steep hillside, you know, you can predict that as well. But really I start looking, and I think this will come up in maybe some of the later questions, but I start looking for points of difference in a lake that I don't know, especially one where I don't have a bathymetric map. So that is one thing. If you're fishing a lake that is fairly popular, there might be an actual contour or bathymetric map that's published for it, so you can get some information for that. And whenever we fish someplace that has those online, I definitely study them to know a bit more about where I might be going. But in general, I just start looking at the edges of a still water and then kind of almost extrapolating from there. And then I look for specific points of structure, like rock points or weedy bays or, you know, logs that are downed and going out into the lake, just areas that look different from the surrounding water. And that's where my eyes tend to go and where I tend to focus. And when I combine that with a thermometer and I know, you know, generally what temperature it is, combine that with what's happening with the wind, whether it be the currents or just chop, I can hopefully come up with a basic idea of what depth to start at, where to focus my efforts at that depth, and then just kind of go at a guess and check pace from there.
You did, because you just brought it up, the temperature. In your book, you talk about, you know, temperature ranges and how that affects the activity of the trout. What ranges are you looking for? And are you dropping a thermometer in a lake if you're out floating? How would you know, or can you extrapolate from a shoreline reading what it might be at different levels?
Yeah, so there are some pretty complex gadgets out there that'll get you, you know, readings at depth. Back when I was doing a lot of limnology work, studying, you know, still waters, when I was a biologist and then also in grad school, I use what's called a YSI meter, a Yellow Springs instrument, and it's on a cord, and it gives you both dissolved oxygen content and temperature as you drop this probe into the water. So you can get a temperature and dissolved oxygen profile from top to bottom with something like that. But your average fly fisher is not going to carry that around. For one thing, they're pretty expensive scientific right. instruments. And really, a lot of times, the depth at which temperature really starts to change, if it's in a clear still water, when we're talking about thermoclines, since that's really what people are typically getting at, that zone mm-hmm. where the temperature rapidly changes in a lake, a lot of times thermoclines are deep enough that they're sort of out of the realm of most fly anglers with traditional cast and retrieve methods, because they can be quite deep. On a clear water, you know, lake, they could be 30 plus feet deep where the thermocline actually is. So, you know, a lot of people, I've heard all sorts of people say, oh, yeah, I was fishing below the thermocline, and that's where I started finding the fish. And I was like, well, but how do you actually know that you were fishing below the thermocline? Without instrumentation, I don't know how you can predict that.
Yeah.
So, and I've heard of some fish finders and whatnot these days that do have predictive thermometers, essentially. I don't know what the actual technology is and how reliable it works, but there is that available. And then there's sort of the old analog method. There is a depth therm that's out there that basically it's a thermometer that allows you to kind of open the cap of this thermometer and fill it, and you can kind of put it on your own rope and put markings on the rope so you know what depth you're at. And then you can mm-hmm. open that at a certain depth, and as long as you bring it up quickly and take the reading before it's had a chance to really change much, then you can kind of get an idea of the temperature change. But I don't really do any of that. Normally, I care about is a surface temperature reading. And based on that surface temperature reading, I know whether it's comfortable for the trout to be shallow or whether it's not. And really, that's what it boils down to. So as long as the temperature is less than about 68 degrees, but especially like 65, that tends to be where they start to try and go a little deeper for sure, if they have access to food in deeper zones anyway, then as long as it's, you know, that temperature or less, I'm probably going to focus, you know, I'm going to start shallow and work my way deep, as opposed to if it's warmer than that, if it's not that much warmer than that, if it's like 70 degrees and warmer, I'm not fishing, because I don't want to bring trout up through that warmest surface layer and play them in that surface layer and then risk putting you know, them back and wondering about their mortality. So I tend to leave a lot of warmer still waters alone in July and August when surface temperatures get too high, because I just don't, you know, I don't need to be responsible for that. So, but if it's, you know, if it's 68 degrees on the surface, then I'm probably going to be looking for fish down 15 feet you know, maybe deeper. So that's when I might, at readings like that, I might start at like mid or lower column and work my way even further down. Whereas if it's 65 or less, then I'm probably going to start fairly close to the top and start working my way down. But that will also be informed by things like the sun angle and the amount of wind chop. Oh. Typically, if you have really high sun angle and no wind, then I'm going to be looking deeper. But if you've got lower sun angles or a lot of chop, then I'll be looking shallower again. So there's a lot of things like that that end up informing what depth I start at and then go from there.
You mentioned wind. How does the wind push fish to one side of a lake or another, or it pushes the bait fish or the insects?
Well, it doesn't necessarily push the fish, but it will certainly push organisms that can't swim very well. So there's actually a story I tell in the book. There was a competition I was fishing at, well, I don't know, it was probably back around 2010, somewhere in there. And we were on a reservoir in Idaho, and the temperatures were such that I expected the fish to kind of be cruising around the shallower west side of the lake and, you know, feeding in that littoral zone. But there was a very consistent west to east wind all day. So basically the littoral zone was on the lee side of the wind, and then this big, deep pelagic zone was on the windward side, you know, the wind where the wind was blowing to. And so I don't know how many boats. We were fishing a lock-style competition, but there was probably half a dozen or eight boats. I can't remember how many. But I was the kind of like one of the only boats that stayed around that shallow west side to fish for the first hour or two. And I only caught one fish, if I remember right, and really didn't have much other interest. And all these other boats had gone across the lake. And I was like, well, shoot, do they know something I don't? And sure enough, when I got over there, as we were rowing over, all of a sudden I saw the lake almost turn like the pea green soup. It went from being kind of clear blue-green or blue to like green. And when I looked down, it was all daphnia. So that strong westward to eastward wind that had been blowing not just that day but for days had blown, you know, these daphnia, which daphnia can swim, but they can't swim well. You'll see them twitching around.
Yeah,
and they're kind
right,
of at the mercy
right,
of current. And they'd been blown to the far side of the lake, kind of, and then they got compacted against that far side where, you know, the wind was just kind of running up against the mountainside. And there were rainbows over there just going to town on these dense, you know, these dense clouds of daphnia that were probably 15 to 20 feet deep. Like, it was, they were all the way from the surface to, like, 20 feet deep, and from top to bottom through that, you know, that part of the column. And there were trout throughout all of them. And I got over there, and people were catching fish like crazy. And I was like, well, I just totally misread the situation.
Well, and similar thing, and I'm wondering if it's just a little variation of what you just talked about, but I was up in a huge lake up in Manitoba fishing for pike, and a storm came up. The wind was blowing in, blowing towards shore, and we were there, and all of a sudden, you know, I would say, you know, within 50 feet of the shore, the water just exploded, and the bait fish were flying out like popcorn, you know, out of the water. And now what I'm thinking is that the bait fish might have been following things like those, you know, the smaller organisms, and then the pike came in because there was an influx of bait fish in the shallow water, and then they were just attacking them. So is that another possibility?
Yeah, it's entirely possible.
Yeah, it's entirely
possible and probably likely. The other thing you have to realize about that situation and any situation with wind, it's just like being in a river. If you go to a really smooth glide or a really smooth pool, the trout or the other fish in those sections of river are kind of on alert because they can see so much more of what's going on above them. So they're alert to overhead predators, whether that's you or, you know, or birds, etc. But as soon as you put a chop on, you know, for instance, if you go in a river and you fish a fast run that's got a ton of waveforms or a shallow riffle, you can usually get closer to the fish, and they don't feel uncomfortable, and those fish end up being easier to catch because there's all that light refraction that's going on from those waveforms as well that tends to just lower the acuity of their sight a little bit because there's just glistening light everywhere, and it's a little bit harder for them to see things very specifically. And the same thing happens in lakes. A lot of times I will just chase chop and I'll chase wind if I have areas of a still water that are calm and areas that show, you know, a riffled surface. Most of the time, that riffled surface, the fish are going to be a lot easier to catch under for the same reasons. They're going to feel safer. They're not going to feel like, you know, ospreys and pelicans and whatever else can see them as easily when that surface is riffled, but also they can't see them as well because that surface is broken. So they're just not as alert to any overhead threats. And then the same thing goes with that light refraction. If you, you know, if you ever watch underwater video, if it's just completely calm, you can see things really clearly underwater. But as soon as you get all those waveforms, that light just dances, you know? It's like a discotheque down there of the sunlight going through a disco ball off the surface. And that, you know, it reduces their capability to see your flies as plainly and as specifically. And so they can't inspect them quite as well. And they're just more likely to put them in their mouth and see if it's food instead of, you know, coming up and in, like those trout that we're doing in France that I was talking about on that lake. It was a really calm surface, and they could just swim around from every angle and try and decide whether it was food. But if you're on a lake where there's a ton of chop, they don't have that opportunity.
There's a question from Chuck in Placerville, California. He says, do you find that early morning working willy buggers and leeches along the shoreline are most effective? Then as the sun comes up, more pupa and midge patterns. It's my understanding that stillwater primarily are pupa eaters for the most part. Does that make
sense? Well, so I don't necessarily agree with that statement, simply because we just went through the various parts of the food web. There's been a lot of focus on kind of corona midge fishing in the stillwater literature for good reason. They're a very important food form, and they're ubiquitous. I mean, there's corona midges in every still water on earth that holds trout. So they're always a food source. But there's a ton of others, depending upon the type of lake that you go to. So it kind of goes back to what type of lake are you fishing again? What's its trophic state?
Yeah.
What's the actual food web in that lake like? And it's certain and it also depends upon when you're fishing there. So if you're fishing there early season, right after ice off, there might be a few early midges out, but by and large, there aren't really any heavy hatches that occur on most of the lakes that I fish until the water gets at least into the mid-40s and often approaching 50. So the coronamid hatches don't really happen in earnest until then. So early in the season, really, you're limited to those streamer or lure approaches, you know, whatever you want to call it. And then there's a really heavy coronamid part of the season, I would say, in kind of late spring, early summer. But then in a lot of mesotrophic lakes, that gives way to more mayflies, caddis, and damsels and dragons in the summer, and the coronamids don't tend to be as effective. And then in the fall, those main hatches of bigger bugs tend to wane. You get kind of smaller coronamids again, but not as dense a hatches of them. So you might have some more good coronamid fishing in the fall again. But in the fall, typically, it's almost always a leech and bugger, you know, or lure game for me, because the main hatches of the year tend to be over. And so the fish are looking for any food sources that remain there year round. And a lot of times that's leeches, scuds, baitfish, that type of stuff. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a lot of, it depends, and a lot of caveats that can be added on to that approach that Chuck was talking about.
There are a lot of things going
on. A lot of times buggers and leeches work. A lot of times, buggers and leeches work great all day in the right conditions.
Right.
Especially
right,
under sun.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, under wind. Like, if you have a windy day, usually the bugger and leech fishing is going to stay strong. Whereas if it does go dead calm, then a lot of times fish do get a little more reticent to eat fast-retrieved, you know, buggers and leeches. But they might take that static or slowly-retrieved coronamid pupa. So, for me, it's more about the conditions, both sun, wind, weather, and then the type of still water you're fishing and the actual food web that's there that ends up determining, you know, a lot of what I'm fishing, whether that be the technique or the flies.
Yeah, a lot of parts and pieces, moving pieces. Matt in Fort Collins, Colorado, says, do you ever get blanked or have really marginal days on still water? I fish once a week on the local public lakes in Colorado and Wyoming, and while I'm pretty average in skill, I'm not a schmuck either. I have more underwhelming days or just straight struggle more often than I'd like. Do you have plenty of below average days as well?
Well, not as often as I certainly once did. I guess it also depends. If it's a totally brand new lake and the fishery is kind of marginal, so to speak, and it's at a tough time of the year with really cold water temperatures, for instance, when the fish just aren't terribly active, like normally post ice out, as soon as the lake fully ices off and you get spring turnover, or fall around the same time again where it's just prior to ice up, there can be some hard fishing in those times, especially on lakes where you might not know very well, or if they're just lakes that don't have a very high density of fish. But for the most part, I have a deep enough quiver to draw on at this point that is, as long as I'm right. able to go through the process of exhausting the different arrows in that quiver, normally I can find at least one or two eventually that kind of hit the mark.
Yeah, yeah. Ron Fisher in New York is going to Scotland next week. He wants to know if you have any advice on fishing the lochs for trout or the rivers for salmon. Have you fished
well,
those lochs?
I don't know anything
over
about fishing the rivers for salmon there, but I have. My first world championship was in Scotland back in 2009.
Oh, wow.
There's a really wide variety of different lochs in Scotland, and so I guess it depends upon which ones he'd be referring to. But basically, there's kind of lochs there that are wild brown trout fisheries. So on most of those, they either strip kind of flashy buggers like humongouses on fairly fast sinking lines, you know, type fives, type sevens, and kind of ripping them in to look like bait fish, or they fish a lot of small black wet flies, biters, they call them a lot back there, but, you know, sort of either palmered or soft tackle black flies kind of high in the column, either on midge tip or floating lines, and you're a bit late for the what they actually call the mayflies there, the Danicas that hatch in May and early June, so that won't be happening, but you could still get some good wet fly fishing or just kind of attractor-based stripping flies. But then there's a lot of other places in Scotland and throughout the UK that, depending upon the fishery you go to, they might be actual stocked pay-to-play fisheries that have a mix of rainbow trout as well as brown trout. And then there's a whole bunch of other tactics that come into play with even flashier flies like blobs and boobies that are fluorescent and you know, ripping approaches like that, or if it's a lake that has a lot of chironomids or what they would call buzzers, then you can also buzzer fish there. And there's a whole bunch of approaches in the book that talk about that, whether you're, you know, most of the time they either fish them under what's called a bung, which is just their version of an indicator, or they'll fish them straight line style. So you might have a really long, flat leader with two or three buzzers on there. And they tend to fish more unweighted buzzers there than we do, but you could also fish, you know, bead-headed buzzers or tungsten-beaded buzzers there too. So all the stuff that we fish here works in Scotland, I guess.
Works
is what
there.
I'm saying. But the challenge is always, you know, figuring out which part or which tactic, which flies, which area of the lake, you know, works best. And there's a lot that goes into that.
Yeah, and Ron, we did, Devin and I did do a show on lock style fishing, which is more about the floating aspects of it, on Ask About Fly Fishing. So you can look that up in our archive
yep.
as well.
And there's
well,
an entire chapter. There's an entire chapter in my book on lock style fishing as well.
And that's where we are now, is that we hardly made a dent in your book. So if you want to learn more, you're going to have to go buy Devin's book. There's a link on our homepage there. Yeah, I mean, Devin, your book is incredible, and it's so thorough and so much to learn out of it. And there's still more questions that we didn't even get to that were sent in. Sorry about that, but that seems to be the way it always ends up. But so check out the book. You'll learn a lot from it. And Devin, hold on a few more minutes. We're going to give away your book here in the next few minutes, so stick around. But unfortunately, we got to wrap this up. And when we return, We will be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International, a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, and a copy of Devin's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing Competition-Inspired Strategies for Everyday Anglers. So hang tight. We'll do that in just a moment. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? And just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you have a chance at winning some of these great prizes. And let me fire up my database here, get that going. Okay. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show to collect your information and so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. Again, that's flyfishersinternational.org. So let's see. Okay. Database spit out Brad Holm in California. Brad Holm, you are now a proud member of Fly Fishers International. So you have a one-year membership to that. So congratulations on that. And now we'll give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. And to find out more about Trout Unlimited, go to tu.org, and you can check out Trout Unlimited there. And our winner there is Richard Scalone, in Ohio. So congratulations, gentlemen, on winning tonight. And thanks for playing. Now let's give away Devin's book, Stillwater Fly Fishing. Answer the question, and the first person that answers it correctly will win Devin's new book. So the question is, we talked a lot, Devin explained thoroughly about food webs, and there were two zones he talked about. Two zones. What are those two zones? Name those two zones, and you'll be a winner of the book. Now, Devin, that takes a minute for them to hear that because there's a slight delay, and then they have to type in the answer, so we've got to fill a bit of time here.
I'm still here, so
you're still here.
I'm always
okay,
capable
good.
Of spewing nonsensical information. So you hit me with what you want to know.
you need to go. You start spelling all those scientific terms so that we can get those. you lost me a long time. Yeah, they were probably biology 101 terms, but you lost me there. Let me see what. Okay, yeah, we got one. Kathy Williams, in Minster, Ohio, says lateral. Well, she says lateral, and but she didn't spell them. I think she's got the answer right. What do you think? Lateral or pelagic? It's
the
littoral.
Pelagic, it'd be littoral, littoral.
Yeah. What do
but
you think?
Close.
Should we give her the book?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's I think, close enough. So, Kathy, you're the proud winner of Devin's new book, Stillwater Fly Fishing. So, Kathy, in that same form, send me your shipping address. Got your email, got your name. I just need your shipping address, and then we'll get Stackpole to ship you out a copy of Devin's new book. So, and thanks for paying attention, taking good notes, and congratulations on winning. Well, Devin, I really appreciate you being on the show again with me. It's always a pleasure. I always learn so much, and you always leave me wanting more. So I'm lucky enough to have a book. So I'll have to do all my studying. But thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah, you're welcome, Roger. I hope everybody enjoyed it. And if they have further questions, they can turn to the book or they can send me an email at the shop at tacticalflyfisher.com. So.
Okay, sounds good. That's a great offer from you. And let me just take it from there. Our next show will be on August 7th. And, yeah, on August 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'm going to be interviewing Jim Slattery, and the show's going to be Catskills to the Madison River. Jim is the mastermind behind the iconic stimulator fly. So you'll learn how about his journey from the Catskills to the banks of the Madison River, his expertise in traditional fly tying, and his role in conservation. So don't miss this chance to hear from one of the most influential figures in fly fishing, discover the secrets behind his success. Tune in for an inspiring and educational conversation. Be sure to add that upcoming show to your calendar. Just on our homepage, right below his photo, you will see Add to Calendar button. Just click on that, add it to your calendar, and you'll be all set. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Bonefish and Tarpon Trust, Stackpole Books, Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics, The Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Enrico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing. What?